Mitzvah Kuf Nun Tes, the 159th mitzvah, is the mitzvah Tumas Shmona Shratzim, the impure status of the eight creepy crawly species mentioned in the Torah. Leo Shmona Shratzim Tameim Umetamim, that the eight types of these Shratzim should be ritually impure and cause others to become ritually impure. Shenemar, Vezelechema Tamei Basheretz Hashereitz, these are the impure things and the creepy things that crawl, Al Haaretz, on the land. So then it lists different types of creatures that are impure. So it says hacholed va'achbar va'atzav va'akoach va'letaav va'achomed va'tinshames. I think that's eight. But and the exact translation of all these things is not exactly clear. We have to ask Rabbi Slifkin exactly what it means. So it's like a mole and a mouse and a weasel and these types of things. So it's lizards, types of lizards. Mishorshi ha-mitzvah. Hakdama. So remember, first of all, he's going to wax poetic here, but we have to remember that in the original order of the Sefer HaChinuch, this mitzvah is a positive commandment, so it comes in the beginning of the Parsha. We're already halfway through the Parsha. What's this Hakdama going on over here? We should have had this way a long time ago. So in the original order of the Sefer HaChinuch, this actually did come before. Lo yisape kol mi sheyesh bo dea shelo haya adam meolam shisig lodas kol hachochma ad sofa. If you have any intelligence in your brain, you will realize that no one who has ever lived has been able to totally encompass within his knowledge all of the wisdom that exists in the world. Shelo yis'alem lo mimena dover, that absolutely nothing should be left out from his knowledge. Shariyafilu ha-Moshe Rabbeinu alav ha-shalom amr zichrono levracha. It says about Moshe Rabbeinu, chamishim sharibinahein, there are 50 gates of understanding, v'chula nimsaru le-Moshe chutz me'achad. And he understood 49 of them, but not the 50th. So even Moshe Rabbeinu was still a human being. To be human means that you don't know everything, and that's an important Musar Vort also. You have to have always have some intellectual humility. V'chein Shlomo HaMelech, HaChacham, that King Solomon, Amar al Atzmo, Amarti Echkama V'hi Rechoka Mimeni. It says in Koheles, which I'm sure you remember from 6 months ago when we read it on Sukkis. So he says, Shlomo says, I, in fact, am very wise. However, the true wisdom is far away from me because as the smarter and more knowledgeable I get, I realize that there's more left out from my purview of knowledge. V'chein lo yisape kol sheyesh lo moach v'kod kodo, anybody who has a brain in his skull, ki Hashem shehu av ha-chochma, except God obviously knows everything. He's the father, so to speak, of all types of wisdom. It's all from God. All the wisdom is included with God. That when God commands us to do something, such as eating, not to eat non-kosher food, or to have these eight types of creatures be ritually impure, that he's doing it for the good for us, for our benefit. And to make us far away from any type of damage. So in other words, the point of the Chinuch's paragraph over here is that our wisdom has limits. We can't say, oh, I don't understand this mitzvah, I don't quite get it, because we have to rely on God, that God knows better than us, and just because we don't understand it, it's not a reason not to perform the mitzvah. Ve'al kein kasher nasig b'chachmaseinu min ha-mitzvos l'das ha-toalos ha-magia lanu bahen nismachbo. But when we sometimes can start to understand the good that comes to us from performing the mitzvos, that is good for us. We should be happy. But if we don't understand, we shouldn't be sad. It's not diametrically opposed. Not that when we get it, we should be happy. And when we don't get it, we should be sad and despondent. Rather, we should just think that, you know, God's smarter than us, and, you know, it's impossible for us to understand everything. So God knows why it's good for us, and we don't necessarily always understand it, but we have to rely on the fact that God knows best. So Chazal are wondering, wouldn't it have been, you know, when you understand things, you remember them better, you can incorporate them into your life better. Like, for example, if you're learning, that's why a lot of rabbis, although they're very important, you know, a lot of rabbis don't like the new genre of what you call kitzur svarim. of it just has the list of halachos without going into the background, because it's harder to memorize a list of laws than it is, you know, if you actually go into the sugya, you see the Gemara, you see the discussions of the Rishonim, you see this is how we come out lemaisa when we paskin, you understand the framework, you understand the relative relative importance of a minag versus a halacha, a deraisa, derabanan, and it's not just a rote system. So it's important to understand what's going on. So why did God write a kitzur sefer? In other words, in most of the time, the Torah acts like a kitzur sefer. It just says the rule. It doesn't really go into the requirements. So we would understand it better if God told us all the reasoning behind all the mitzvos. So the reason that the Torah did not do this, it didn't explain all the reasons. V'amru shaya hadavar shelo yialanu kishalon bazeh. We should, because not only it couldn't truly contribute to our understanding positively, but there's another aspect to it which it could cause us to fail in certain aspects. So if you, Raya, what's the proof for this? Shrei shlosha mehen. There are three mitzvos in the Torah. Sho nizgala taman v'nichshal behen gadol holam. So what are the... One second. So there are three mitzvos. Which are the three mitzvos in the Torah that it says the reason explicitly? When it talks about the king... So it says the king shouldn't have too much money because he has to be connected to his people. He can't think that he's super, super rich and he can do whatever he wants and the people are just little peasants. And he can't have too many wives because they're going to distract him from his work and his service of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And he can't have too many horses because we don't want Jewish people to be too involved in Egypt and to go to Egypt to get horses because they're apparently the center of the horse trade. So he shouldn't have too many horses because he'll be too tempted to be too involved and to go to Egypt. So there it says specifically in the Torah the reason for those three mitzvos. It doesn't just say he shouldn't have too many wives, he shouldn't have too much money, he shouldn't have too many horses. So who was Nichshal in this? Shlomo HaMelech, even though the Gemara, it's true, it does only talk about two of them, he was seemingly Nichshal in all three. The commentators discuss why, in our version of the Gemara, at least, it leaves out the third. But in any case, he said, so I see, the reason that for too many wives is that they're going to turn away your heart, so I have confidence in myself, I'm going to, I can be strong, and I'm very religious, so it doesn't matter, I can have as many wives as I want. And they're not going to turn my heart away from God. Well, guess what happened? They did turn his heart away from God, and he allowed them to worship their avodah zarah while they were under his roof. And that was indeed a major problem. He also had too much money. He also had too many horses, etc. And he did too much business with Egypt. So you see that when there's a balance between knowing the reason behind the mitzvah and knowing absolutely that this is the reason, so then you might be tempted to say, well, I'm stronger than this. Like, a lot of times, there's a halacha called yichud, that men and women in many situations are not allowed to be alone together. So obviously the reason is to prevent an illicit affair happening over here. So people might say, well, the reason for yichud is to prevent an illicit affair. So I know that it's not going to happen with me and this person. So I don't have to observe the laws of yichud. Yeah, it's never going to happen. Well, guess what? Sometimes it does happen. So again, not that it's possible to totally prevent any sin from ever happening. But then within the framework that we have to observe the halachos, even if we think that the reason doesn't apply to us. Uchvar hodiyun, aval yachshov tofeis lavo alayim hamashal sha'amru zichronim levracha. So wait a minute, Sefer HaChinuch, you just told us that we shouldn't be looking for the reasoning behind the mitzvahs. So, hello. So tell me, so we have a statement in Maseches Pesachim that says, Kapa dechak nagara bein nisrof chardala, that the spoon that the carpenter makes, so he will eat mustard, he eats mustard with that spoon. So this statement is actually said in the Gemara, where there's some in Yonah Diyom over here. It's in the Gemara in Pesachim, where there's a famous disagreement between Reb Yehuda and the Rabbanan about how to dispose of chametz before Pesach. What Reb Yehuda says, the only way to dispose of chametz is through
burning.
And the other rabbis disagreed with him, and they said, no, any method is sufficient. You could crush it into little pieces and throw it into the sea. when the seed can become chametz, you can't eat drink the water in Rosh Pesach. That's a different story. So
wait. Breadcrumbs
in the well.
What?
Make sure it's a salty sea.
Salty sea, yeah. Right?
So Lamaisa, by the way, you know, this is an issue that comes up every
Pesach. With the Kinneret?
Huh? No. About how to dispose of our chametz. You know.
Right, because I burn it outside and it doesn't burn. So then I say, okay.
Right, so the rabbis, right, so the rabbi, the other rabbis would disagree with Reb Yehuda, say that any method is sufficient, including nowadays we assume that flushing it, of course, flushing it down the toilet, it would also be sufficient. They didn't have toilets in the times of Chazal, so they didn't say this. I mean, they didn't have indoor plumbing toilets. So we try, ideally, to be stringent to try to accommodate the opinion of Reb Yehuda, but we're really paskin like the Rabbanan, that you can dispose of your chametz in any way possible. So when possible, do... Again, the problem is a lot of times it doesn't burn. So they had there are people who are pointing out that in order to make it burn better, they poured gasoline on it, and then...
No, also, that means that it becomes...
Right.
It's not chametz anymore.
That's the problem, that not only is it dangerous... That as soon as you poured the gasoline on it, that's the destruction of the chametz. So you don't even, because it's not edible anymore. So then when you light it on fire, you're destroying chametz that's destroyed already. So you're not fulfilling the mitzvah of burning the chametz at all. You have to burn the chametz while it's still edible. So if you leave it in the fire for long enough, it'll get destroyed if they have these public fires. But also you have to make sure to destroy the chametz before you say the bittul, where you would nullify any chametz that's in your possession. Because once you nullify the chametz that's in your possession, then it's not yours anymore, so you haven't fulfilled the mitzvah of destroying the chametz that you own, yeah?
You could start burning it and then pour gas on it?
If the kezias burns by itself, then you could pour gas on it afterwards. But you shouldn't pour gas on a fire that's currently burning.
Yeah, that's a terrible idea.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea.
No, you could turn it off and then back on.
Huh?
No. Just pour it, just after it burns a little bit, because I spurt one, but then you can flush the rest down the toilet.
Okay.
No big deal. So actually, Rabbi Sobolovsky, there was a rabbinic conference that took place a couple weeks ago. So Rabbi Sobolovsky gave a shiur about Inyanei Pesach. So he said that people are so intent. Again, we don't paskel like Rabbi Yehuda, though we try to, again, it's only to try to accommodate his opinion ideally that we try to burn it. The people are so intent on this idea that you have to burn the chametz, and they give you, you know, when all these charities, they send you bedikas chametz kits that contain an envelope and a spoon and a candle and a feather and a candle.
Flashlight.
So they so intent on that they have to use the bedikas chametz kits. First of all, according to me, none of these things are required for bedikas chametz. None of the things included in the kit are required at all for bedikas chametz, but you can use a flashlight, you can clean with whatever you want, you don't have to use a feather. There are much more efficient ways of doing it nowadays, and you don't need a spoon, you can pick it up or whatever you want, whatever utensil you want.
Just one more last thing, you know, yeah. Lisa, okay. What's your eights about, you know, whether you should actually hide 10 pieces of chametz in order to find them, you know?
The hiding 10 pieces of chametz is very interesting, because there's this minhag that developed later, it's quoted from... Question is this really necessary? And the answer,
which part are you talking?
To put out bread during bedikas chametz.
To
put out pieces of bread. So the answer really is no, because the mitzvah really is to check for chametz. The mitzvah is not to find chametz. You don't have to. If you don't find chametz, there's no problem whatsoever. However, there are some poskim, the Vilna Gaon especially. You keep some aside. You don't have to put it out to search for. You can know you have in your closet a little bit of chametz.
You don't want to have a situation which sometimes happens where, whoops, you have nine here. Where's the tenth?
You have to recheck. It's a major problem. You could create problems with that, but nevertheless, that is the general custom. So the Vilna Gaon said, also he paskin like the Ikar Adin, that you don't need, if you just need to search, you don't need to find anything. You should not put out these 10 pieces of chametz. It's unnecessary. However, some poskim nowadays point out that before Pesach now, we clean so thoroughly that maybe that is a de facto bedikas chametz. In the olden days, the bedikas chametz was basically their cleaning for Pesach, because they had tiny houses, and it wasn't embedded the same way, I guess. So nowadays, when we clean a room very thoroughly, and we're certain that there's no chametz therein, then that is a de facto bedikas chametz, so maybe it would in fact be a bracha levatala if we don't put out some pieces of chametz to search for. Some poskim have pointed that out nowadays, but again, if you're afraid it's going to cause problems, or your little kids who are going to hide a piece, then again, it's only a minhag, strictly speaking. I think even nowadays, it's okay to perform bedikas chametz without these 10 pieces, but again, that is the general practice. So Rabbi Selsky was saying that people are so intent on using this B'digas Chametz kit and burning it on Erev Pesach that he knew some person who was flying to their Pesach destination on Erev Pesach, and they brought the little envelope with a feather and the spoon and the little pieces of Chametz in it, and lo and behold, the plane was delayed. So they had the time for Bir Chametz, or burning Chametz, was on while he was traveling on the airplane. So they had to frantically try to explain to the stewardess that he has these little pieces of bread and he has to dispose of them thoroughly, preferably by burning, if she has a match or something.
Oh, God.
Yeah, good luck with that. So on the... Rabbi Solovsky said, which is not his Chiddush, it's Pashut, that if you are traveling, do not take with any chametz with you if you are traveling away for Pesach. If you wish to, ideally, to perform this minag of actually trying to burn the chametz, when you arrive at your destination, if you arrive in time, have your host gift you a small piece of chametz, which you may then throw into the fire, and that is certainly sufficient for fulfilling this minag, but do not travel with any chametz. Anyway, so the discussion in the Gemara between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbanan, they're trying to prove their opinions about whether getting rid of the chametz requires burning or not. So they're trying to make comparisons with the karbanos. So finally, the rabbis say to Rabbi Yehuda, who says that you have to dispose of the chametz through burning, they say, oh, but this korban, you say can be buried, and we say has to be burnt. So you say in this case that it doesn't even have to be burnt. So ha, your statement about the korban worked against you. You shot yourself in the foot. So now we disproved your opinion about burning the chametz. So that's what it says in the Gemara, that the spoon that the carpenter made, he'll have to eat mustard and therefore, you know, burn his mouth. He'll have to eat mustard with that spoon. The thing that you made, it will now cause you pain. So the statement that he made in another place was his undoing regarding his statement about burning the chametz. So the Sefer Chinuch says, you could apply the statement to me. I just said that you shouldn't search for the reasoning behind the mitzvah. So what have I been doing this whole time? Kappa d'chak nagara b'nisrof chardla. But Masha Amarti Achshav Shashem Heli Menu Tameh Mitzvos, God intentionally withheld from us the reasoning behind the mitzvos. V'anuchi haroi Musi Yodi L'daber Behen Dover Al Nari, that I'm writing this book for my son and his friends to entertain themselves on Shabbos afternoon. Just like kids nowadays, they pull out the Sefer HaChinuch and they're totally content to quietly entertain themselves all Shabbos afternoon. So I'm trying to write all the mitzvos, the reasoning for all the mitzvos. So how can I do that? Kivar kidmani rabosai ledaber ben kama dvarim ben midrashim mekomos achirim al tzad pshatam. He said, yeah, but I'm really just following in the footsteps of my teachers and the midrashim, which sometimes, you know, try to give simple understanding reasons for the mitzvos. The Omek Chachmas and the Chozik Binas of Rav Kedushasim Ganus Besochan. That still, the total holiness and the total depths of their wisdom is still hidden within it. Afilu Kol Aruchos Lo Yazizu Osan. You can't really get to the bottom of it. Even it says all the winds will not blow it. The Chol Amamik Eitzah B'Pshatayim V'Shtad Al Chadish Dover B'Niglo Shebehen. But it's different when I'm just trying to give the reasons that I give are not saying that this is the reason. It's just trying to work on giving it a little bit of a taste to help people digest it, to give a more logical reason and through the simple understanding. So I'm a little bit just, you know, timidly trying to look at their power. So I really shouldn't be too embarrassed about this. So somebody who does this, it's not correct to place guilt on him. So really, you should be praising me. Not that I have guilt for trying to uncover the reasoning of the mitzvahs. I'm just trying to do my best to give a little taste to them, and I'm following in the footsteps of my predecessors who did try to give some simple understandings of the reasons of the mitzvah. So I'm just doing that. So you should praise me for doing so. That God's wisdom is the greatest wisdom. That he's commanding us things for the best. So based on this understanding, we should have no questions whatsoever regarding the laws of kashrus, the laws of forbidden foods. Why should that be? Ki yodanu be'emes shakol atov. We should just have faith that these things are bad for us, and we shouldn't eat them. Val tisma bni al inyani hatuma im hunelam harbe al kolbiria. So again, it's also referring to the tumah, not just of eating, but the tumah of the ritual purity and impurity. So don't be surprised about the ritual purity and impurity, because nobody can fathom what's going on over there. It's really beyond us. Because the impurity could cause damage and some sort of ill to the soul. That's what the sages have told us. I pointed this out in a previous year, that the word venitmesem, that you should become impurified through the impure foodstuffs, is written without an aleph, so it could also be read as venitamtem, that you should be closed up through it. Kolomar, shemayanos haseichel shu hanefesh hakemes mekalkel miktsas beinyan hatuma. So both in terms of eating non-kosher foods, and in terms perhaps of the ritual purity and impurity, this causes a closing up of the heart, that when you contract, when you would come into contact with these things that have negative physical or spiritual effects, then that causes your heart to close up. And we pointed this out before, that this is the reason that Hasidim especially take this very seriously and are very stringent about the laws of kashrus in general, because they feel that if you eat non-kosher foods, that will affect your spiritual level. And affecting spirit, if you're spiritual, people who are very closed off, very isolated, so if people's spiritual level starts to go down, it's not going to be so easy to close yourself off from the outside world, which is what they expect from their constituents. That's my over-interpretation of their hakpadas in the laws of kashrus. Well, tisma b'hiskalkel haseichel b'inyonim hagashmiyim afal pi she'ein mino. So how could one's intelligence, one's soul, be affected by physical things, eating physical things or coming into contact with tumma, even though it has nothing to do, I guess the eating really, has nothing to do with, it's a separate type of thing. It's not, in other words, how could a physical thing affect a spiritual thing? So, unfortunately, the heilige soul, the exalted soul, has to be housed in a body. And since it's connected to the physical body, so therefore the things that affect the physical body, physical things, can affect the soul sort of by extension. It's not that they directly affect the soul, but since it affects the body, and the body is a partner with the soul to form the human being, and so then it does affect the soul. Bimkein anachnu bnei yish baniyus datenu lo neda nefesh umahusa. We don't know exactly what the soul is. Beichnil al adas refuaso machaloso miderech hachakira. Halol arofim ein tachbula berefuat hikiram ikar hamachala. So we can't understand what affects the soul and what doesn't affect the soul, because we don't really understand how the soul works or what the soul really is in an absolute sense. So how can we understand what affects it negatively or what affects it positively? It's like a doctor going to a doctor, and the doctor says, I feel sick. The doctor says, well, I need more description than that. You need to tell me how you feel sick, where in your body. In order to heal it and to know how the medicine interplays with the body, you need to know exactly what's going on. You can't just say, I'm sick, and the doctor says, okay, here's a shot. This is going to fix your illness. No, you have to understand. If we don't understand the soul, we can't understand how these things affect it. So all these things of ritual impurity, we should not go after their roots. Unless we know exactly what's going on with the soul. So exactly how the soul works, figuratively, it's going in and it's going out, how it behaves. The Havein Zevedoi, who understand this, Kivo Nimzok Tzas Chuval Kol Shorshe Amitzvos Atuma Vatara, Adesher Kimat Yeh Masvel Panenu Bechidush Para Aduma. So this is a sort of answer to the trying to find the reasoning for the ritual impurity. So there's it's like to cover our faces because we're a little embarrassed because we can't figure out what's going on at all. Like, for example, we have the Para Aduma. Shematama Hatar Matairis Hatame, that the famous thing about the Parah Aduma is that the person who's working with the Parah Aduma becomes Tame, and the person upon whom the ashes of the Parah Aduma are sprinkled becomes pure, becomes Tahor. So how could the same object cause Tuma and Tahara at the same time? So we don't really know what's going on. V'gam sham narech binyan bezras Hashem. When we get to the mitzvah Parah Aduma, which is mitzvah Shin Sadi Zion, 397, so we have a ways to go, over 200 mitzvahs to go. L'kabel schar b'gia limso divrei chepetz. At least even if we can't figure it out, we'll try to, we'll get some reward for at least attempting to work on exactly what's going on over here. Dinei ha-mitzvah, the lachos of the mitzvah of the Tumah Shmonah Shratzim. Mashamar zichrono l'racha, sheshmonah shmatzim heima nikroim av ha-tumah. That these eight types of creepy crawly creatures are called the father of a tuma. So we have in the laws of tuma and tara, we have a few different types of things. So we have what we call avi avos hatuma, that the grandfather of tuma, which is, there's only really one example of that and some things that are associated with it, but
it's a mace.
That is a mace, a dead body, which causes other objects to become an av hatuma and now can distribute tuma to everything. An avatuma, the father tuma is the only thing that can distribute tuma to everything. Then you have the avatuma, and then you have what you call the vlad hatuma, a little baby tuma, literally, that it's derived, something that became tame because of an avatuma is now a vlad hatuma. And this difference is follows. Kolomar shemetamin adam vekelim b'maga. So, right, so there are the most easy types of things to become tame are foods and beverages. So foods and beverages can become tame with anything, basically. But the avatuma can only cause a person and vessels to become tame. So a person and vessels are harder to become tame than foods and beverages. So if a person and a vessel can only become tame only through an ava tuma, or of course an avi avos tuma, for the father tuma or the grandfather tuma. So if as soon as the ava tuma, the father tuma touches the, or in some cases is carried by a person, but if it touches a person or it touches vessels, then those the person and the vessels become tame. V'makelim shel cheres metamen osam mikevan sheyikansu besoch aviro. And that's referring only to metal utensils and the like. However, there is a very unique thing about kli cheres, earthenware vessels, that they do not become tame. If something touches them on the outside, that's an avatuma, so the vessel does not become tame at all. A earthenware vessel only becomes tame if the object goes into the airspace of the inside of the earthenware vessel.
Airspace.
Yeah, so let's say you have this bottle. Right. So let's say you have this. Let's say this bottle is made of metal. So then you have a avatuma, a father tuma around, and you touch it, and it touches the bottle. So the bottle becomes tame. But if this bottle were made of earthenware, and you have an avatuma coming over here, and it touches the vessel, that would do absolutely nothing. It's very interesting. It would do absolutely nothing. However, if you take the avatuma and you dangle it inside, this were an earthenware vessel, so then this vessel would become tame, even if it didn't touch. As long as it went into the airspace, then it would become tame. V'zeh chiluk sheish binyan ha-tuma bein ma shenikra av le ma shenikra vlad. The difference between a father tuma and a baby tuma, she'anikra av metame adam v'kelim, that's an ava tuma can impurify a person or a vessel or a food or a beverage. The anikra vlad eno metame adam v'kelim, and something that became tame through an avatuma that is now a vlad atuma, that's now a baby level of tuma, that can cause food and beverages to become tame, but that cannot cause a person or a vessel to become tame. There are only four types of things in the world that can become tame: people, Jewish people, that is, although there are rabbanan tumas that have applied to non-Jews also. People, vessels, food, and beverages. Those are the only types of things in the world. It's a lot of things. But there are, those are the only types of things in the world that can become tame. So, in food and person and kalim are harder to become tame. Those can only become tame if they come into contact with an ava tuma, a father tuma. And the food and beverages become tame whether they come into contact with an ava tuma or they come into contact with something that has been impurified by an ava tuma.
Like the vessel.
Right. If now this vessel that has become tame through an ava tuma is now used for a certain type of food and now comes into contact with food, so that food becomes tame, whereas if now a person comes into contact with that vessel, so the person does not become tame. You have to chaz this. Basic Mikdash is going to be rebuilt soon, everyone. You have to got to learn good. Okay, so v'ashrotzim ein ha-metam. What? But it has nothing to do with kashrus. In fact, it's the opposite of kashrus, because stone vessels, if you cook in them, they absorb taste. So therefore, they need to be kashered.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas they don't become tame in the sense of ritual impurity. So it's the opposite. It's no connection to each other. By kashers, it just depends on which vessels absorb taste. And for tumah, it's a totally different order of laws. These eight types of creepy crawly creatures do not impurify until they die. Once they're alive, you can have a pet lizard all you want and play with it, and it will not make you tame. Shneamar hanogea b'hem b'mosam yitma, that somebody who touches them when they die should become tame. It's pretty explicit. Ushmona shrotzim elu davka hushim etamen. It's only these eight types of shrotzim that cause ritual impurity. About kolshar shrotzim, other types of shrotzim such as nachash v'akrav, a snake, a scorpion, v'chayotzei b'en enam etamen klal. Even when they're dead, they do not cause any type of ritual impurity. Obviously, again, there's a difference between kashrus and ritual impurity. You're not allowed to eat snakes, and you're not allowed to eat scorpions. That would be usur d'oraisa, absolutely. But they do not cause ritual impurity. V'din ashrotzim hu she'ena metamim b'masa b'li maga. And these types of shrotzim, if you carry them, then they do not make you tame. It's only if you actually touch them directly. Correct, which is not the case, for example, we're going to learn in a couple of mitzvahs. So now there's a tumas nevela, that if an animal dies without the shechita, then it has tumas nevela, if it just dies. So, and then it has what we call tumas masa, that if you pick it up, even if you don't touch it, then you become tame. So, for example, if you go to the grocery store and they have meat there, non-kosher beef, so it's completely packaged, nice, sterile-looking plastic packaging. So if you take the packaging and go like this, you would not become tame. But if you lift up the packaging, even though you're not touching it at all, it's completely ensconced in plastic packaging, you would become tame because that has what we call tumas masa, that if you carry it, it makes you tame, even if you don't come in direct contact. That's not the case with the shrotzim, that it's only if you actually touch them. That's again by a nevela also, that it has extra power, that the clothes that you're wearing when you carry it also become tame, whereas it's not the case by the shrotzim, that it would not make your clothes tame, just by you touching it. The shir tumas asheretz b'cha'ad asha, the size of how much of the sheretz has to be present and you touch it for you to become tame, it's found in the Gemara all over, that it's the size of a lentil.
Sure.
Lentil. And as we know, lentils are, practically the size of an egg, like we know, of course. No, talking about really the size of a lentil, of course, nowadays, whatever. But talking about really a tiny, tiny thing. It's the size of a lentil. It's even smaller than a kezias.
How do you know?
Sha Torah tima'aton stam. V'yeshmen shrotzim she'enon elokad ashad. The Torah says that these are all tomei, and one of these shrotzim can be as small as a lentil. I don't know which one. Again, we don't know the exact translations. But that's since the smallest one is the size of a lentil, so from the lentil size of any of them, B is tummy. The chol ha-shrotzim mitztarfin la-chadasha. Let's say you have little pieces, tiny little pieces from all eight, or any of any combination of the eight, and you have tiny little pieces that come together in a ball, and that's the size of an adasha, and a lentil, then that would be tummy. Kilomar afilu ma'at mizeh.
Okay, so
It shouldn't say it's only, you might think it has to be a lentil size from one specific sheretz at a time. Mm-hmm. No, they can all combine and form the size of a lentil. Vadin basar chaya porish min sheretz, that if it leaves the sheretz, veivrechad sholim, that it has to have, in order to become tamei, again, it has to have the characteristics of a whole sheretz. So if something leaves, if it's a, let's say even smaller than an adasha, but it's a full aver of the sheretz, it's a full limb of the sheretz, or a limb falls off the sheretz while it's still alive, then it would have, you needs to have meat and some sinews and some, it needs to have different characteristics of a full sheretz. It has to have different types of body parts in order to qualify for the tumah. But if it doesn't have, it has to have basar v'gidim atzamah, it has to have bones and sinews and flesh. V'akulia v'akoved v'aloshon, but what about a full limb such as a kidney or a liver or the tongue? So that doesn't have all those characteristics, it doesn't have bones and sinews, so it's just a piece of flesh, even though it's a whole part of the sheretz, that would not count to become tummy. V'din daman v'gidan v'tzipornan v'oran v'tzatzan. So let's say blood and sinews and the nails. So the blood and sinews and the nails, while they're attached, they count towards the size of an adasha. But if they're just separate, if they're not still attached to the part of the body, and you touch them, or let's say the whole sheretz is dead and you just touch the nails and you just touch the blood, so that would, in fact, render you tamei, but if just the blood or the nails or the sinews are separate, then that would not render you tamei. The ein mitzdarfin lechdash. I'm sorry, I made a mistake. That if they do not count towards the shear of an adosh, if it's just if it's not part of the actually attached to the sheretz body. The oran, the skin. There's a difference between different types of shratzim. So some shratzim, the skin is nice and supple and soft, and that's like the flesh itself. Because this, it's considered to be just like part of the flesh, because the skin is so supple and soft. But there are the other types of shratzim where the skin is actually hard and more like a protective coat. So in that case, the skin would be tahar, would be the same as like a bone or a sinew. Ubeitzasan, what about an egg? So if the egg is whole, even if there's a baby sheretz developing inside, not all these species obviously lay eggs, but for the ones that do lay eggs, then even though the sheretz is developing inside, if you touch the egg, so that is still tahor. However, if the egg has any type of hole in it, even the tiniest little hole, then you would be tamei, because you theoretically could stick your finger in the hole and now touch the baby sheretz that's developing inside. But if the egg is complete, the shell is completely whole, then you do not, then it was not, would not be tamei. So when someone becomes tamei, what are the ramifications? So you're not allowed to eat the truma if you're a kohen, or you're not allowed to eat sacrifices, you're not even allowed to go into the Beis HaMikdash until you immerse yourself in a ritual bath, into the mikvah. And a few mitzvahs from now, we're going to get to the mitzvah of tvilah, how ritual immersion is performed, and what type of body of water, etc. So until you perform the ritual immersion, you remain in your tamei status, and you may not do any of these activities that a person who's tamei is prohibited from performing. So we have an additional level of qualification to engage in any of these activities, like eating the korbanos, which is that not only going to the mikvah doesn't automatically purify you, it's going to the mikvah plus a waiting until sunset that night. Not necessarily what we call sunset, but perhaps when the light of the sun disappears. So at that time, you may eat truma and you may go into the Beis HaMikdash. Your tahara process is completed once at that time. So it's all explained in the order of the Mishnah, which is about ritual purity and impurity, and also in the tractates of Kalim, which talks about the ritual purity and impurity of vessels, and Taros, which is the same, again, it's the same name as the order of the Mishnah and a specific tractate within the order of Taros, both called Taros, which talks about general halachos of Tumah v'Taro, which are not included in any of the other more specific tractates of the order of Taros. In all places and all times, males and females, leading shekal nidma b'shratzim nikratame. What does it mean that it's in all places and all times? I mean, it doesn't matter anymore because we don't have the Beis HaMikdash. But Theoretically, now if you touch a sheretz that's dead, then you become tummy. Mm-hmm. You become tummy, but it has no effect on you. So who cares? Yeah. Velo yale mitumaj yidbol b'mayim kedino. You don't become ois tummy. Untameified until you are the mikvah, mikomakom, achshav, shein lanu bavonasin, lo mikdash, lo taros. Now that we don't have base mikdash and no pure and impure foods, such as truma, ein lanu limnosa bechezu mitzos hanehugos. It's not counted among the list of applicable mitzvos. So misha mitame afilu ledas becholzman, ein olav chet bazeh. It's not a prohibition, it's not a sin to become tamei. It's only that you're restricted from performing certain activities until you become tummy. Of course, like before holidays, for example, that everybody has to go to the Beis HaMikdash and eat certain korbanos, then you have to become tahor. That's part of the mitzvah. But if you... But yet, should still try to prevent yourself from becoming tummy because it's not good for you. But again, we don't really have... That's in times of the Beis HaMikdash because we observe as well, but nowadays the whole system is no longer applicable, so we don't worry about this. The Chos of HaRamban, Zichron Elvracha, Shein Lanu Lachshav Min HaMitzvah, is called Dinei HaTumah. The Ramban says you shouldn't count each thing that governs the halachos of Tumah V'Tara as a separate mitzvah. The Sefer HaMitzvah Shelo, because of Tam Nachon Nidvar, but the Sefer HaMitzvah of the Ramban doesn't really mean the Sefer HaMitzvah of the Ramban. He didn't write a Sefer HaMitzvah, so he wrote a commentary on the Rambam Sefer HaMitzvah, which is funny because in the old literature, a lot of times they say Sefer HaMitzvah, the Sefer Shiloh, that his book, it's not really talking about his book, it's talking about his commentary on that book. Like it says about the Vilna Gaon, when they talk about Shulchan Aruch Shiloh, the Shulchan Aruch of the Ra. He didn't write a book called the Shulchan Aruch, he wrote a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. So his Shulchan Aruch means his commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. So he said a lot of times the Chinuch really agrees with the Ramban. Why? Because he's from the students of the Ramban. He's from the Ramban school of thought. He has allegiance to the Rebbe, but he also finds it more reasonable. I'm not going to repeat all the Ramban's arguments of why he doesn't want to count each of these as a mitzvah. Hinei b'mitzvah tzadivav, the 96 mitzvah, the sefer mitzvahs of the Ramban. Besifro timtzah inyan baruka. Besofa inyan, you'll find that you can look at length over there. Not so long. It's a paragraph or two. Besofa inyan, amar shashem min anu milasos hadvarim betuma. The mitzvah is that God says, you're not allowed to do X, Y, and Z when you're tamei. Venishar aleinu lo dienu eizadavar watuma. So he tells you, it just informs you what causes you to become tamei and what doesn't. If you touch a dead body or a sheretz or all these other things, you don't count them as separate mitzvahs. The mitzvah is, if you're tamei, do not go into the Beis HaMikdash. If you're tamei, do not eat sanctified foods. So the other stuff is just telling you what constitutes being tamei. It's not a mitzvah that this should cause tuma, and this should cause tuma, and this should cause tuma, this should cause tuma. That's the Ramban's approach. And again, since he deletes so many mitzvos, he has to come up with other mitzvos to fill in what's considered a separate mitzvah that the Rambam counted as included in a different mitzvah. It's like there's a list of disqualifications that render a kohen or an animal unfit for service in the Beis HaMikdash. So it doesn't say that even the Rambam doesn't count each mum as a separate thing. This should be a mum, this should be a mum, this should be a blemish, this should be a blemish, and that you take so many mitzvahs. The Ramban says the same thing over here. He says that you're not allowed to offer a blemish in the Beis HaMikdash, and then he told you which are blemishes. So you're not allowed to eat this while you're tamei, so these are the things that cause tamei. It shouldn't be counted as a separate mitzvah. Not each thing is counted as a specific mitzvah, rather there are just details of the general mitzvah and qualifications of it.